in aromatherapy form. A crease formed in between Jules's brows, and Carswell recognized confusion. He was just about to explain what an aphrodisiac was when a third form sidled up beside them. "Hey, Carswell," said Elia, the pep squad captain, slipping her hand into the crook of his elbow. She was easily one of the prettiest girls in school, with thick black hair and a persistent dimple in one cheek. She was also a year older and about 4 inches taller than Carswell, which wasn't particularly uncommon these days. Unlike Jules, Carswell hadn't seen even a glimmer of a growth spurt yet, and he was really starting to get fed up with waiting, even though none of the girls seemed bothered by the fact that they'd been outpacing him in the height department since their sixth year. "Morning, Elia," Carswell said, slipping the canister of facial cream into his pocket. "Perfect timing. Could you do me a favor?" Her eyes widened with blatant enthusiasm. "Of course. Could you tell me, what does my good friend Jules here smell like to you?" Instant redness flushed over Jules's face, and with a snarl, he pushed Carswell into the lockers again. "What are you?" But then he froze. Carswell's teeth were still vibrating when Elia leaned forward so that her nose was almost touching Jules's neck and sniffed. Jules had become a statue. Carswell lifted an expectant eyebrow. Elia rocked back on her heels, considering for a moment as her gaze raked over the ceiling. Then,
"Almonds, I think."
"And do you like it?" Carswell ventured. She laughed, the sound like an inviting wind chime. Jules's blush deepened.
"Definitely," she said, although it was Carswell she was smiling at. "It reminds me of one of my favorite desserts."
Jules released him, and once again, Carswell smoothed his jacket. "Thank you, Elia. That's very helpful."
"My pleasure." She tucked a strand of hair behind her ear. "I was wondering if you're going to the peace dance next week."
His smile was both practiced and instinctual.
"Undecided. I may be cooking dinner for my sick grandmother that night."
He waited expectantly as Elia's gaze filled with swooning. "But if I do end up going to the dance, you'll be the first I ask to go with me." She beamed and bounced on her toes for a moment.
"Well, I'd say yes," she said, looking suddenly briefly bashful, just in case you weren't sure.
Then she turned and practically skipped down the hall.
"Well," said Carswell, pulling the canister back out of his pocket, "I guess our business is all concluded then. Like I said, I'll return your payment in full by second period. Of course, the retail price on this stuff just went up 20%, so if you change your mind later, I'm afraid I'm gonna have to charge."
Jules snatched the canister out of his hand. His face was still bright red, his brow still drawn, but the anger had dissolved from his eyes.
"If nothing's changed in another 3 weeks," he said, low and threatening, "I'll be shoving the rest of this cream down your throat."
Well, most of the anger had dissolved from his eyes anyway. But Carswell merely smiled and gave Jules a friendly pat on the chest just as the anthem of the American Republic began to blare through the school speakers.
"So glad I could clear things up for you."
Turning, Carswell waved his wrist over his locker to unlock the ID-coded mechanism and gathered up his things, as polite a dismissal as he could give. He walked into literature class 4 minutes late, his book bag over one shoulder as he deftly buttoned up his blazer. He slid into the only remaining seat, front row, dead center.
"So nice of you to join us, Mr. Thorne," said Professor Gosnell.
Crossing his ankles, Carswell tipped back in his chair and flashed a bright smile at the teacher.
"The pleasure is all mine, Professor Gosnell."
She sighed, but he could see the corner of her mouth twitch as she punched something into her port screen. Within moments, the screens built into the classroom desks lit up with the day's assignment. "Great Dramatist of the First Century, Third Era," was emblazoned across the top,
followed by a list of names and which of the 6 earthen countries each dramatist had hailed from.
For today, I want everyone to select one artist from this list, said the teacher, pacing in front of the classroom, and choose a drama from their body of work that appeals to you. At 1:30, we'll split into pairs, and you can take turns reading the dramas you found with your partner and discussing how the themes in them relate to our world today. A finger tapped Carswell gently at the base of his neck, the universal symbol for "I choose you." Carswell struggled to remember who had been sitting behind him when he took this seat, and if it was someone he wouldn't mind being partnered with. Had it been Destiny? Athena? Blakely? Spades, he hoped it wasn't Blakely. Once she started talking, it was difficult to remember what peace and quiet sounded like. He slid his gaze to the side, hoping he could catch his mystery partner's reflection in the windows before committing to the partnership. When his gaze caught on the girl sitting in the seat beside him, Kate Fallow. His gaze narrowed thoughtfully. Despite having been in the same grade since toddler primaries, he doubted that he and Kate had spoken more than 50 words to each other their whole lives. He didn't think it was anything personal. Their paths just hadn't crossed much. As evidenced at that moment, she preferred to sit in the front of the class, whereas he did his best to end up somewhere near the back. Instead of coming out to sporting events or school festivals, Kate always seemed to rush straight home when classes were over. She was at the top of their class and well-liked, but by no means popular, and she spent most lunch hours with her nose buried in her port screen, reading. This was only the second time Carswell Thorne had stopped to ponder one Kate Fallow. The first time, he had wondered why she liked books so much, and if it had anything to do with why he liked spaceships, because they could take you somewhere far, far away from here. This time, he was wondering what her math score was. There was a thud as Carswell settled his chair legs back onto the floor and leaned across the aisle.
You probably know who all these writers are, don't you?
Kate's head whipped up. She blinked at him for a moment before her startled eyes glanced at the person behind her, then back to Carswell. He grinned. She blinked. Excuse me? He inched closer so that he was barely seated on the edge of his chair and dragged the tip of his stylus down her screen. All these dramatists. You read so much, I bet you've already read them all. She followed the tip of his stylus before... There it was, that sudden rush of color to her cheeks. No, not all of them. Maybe half, though? Yeah? Settling an elbow on his knee, Carswell cupped his chin. Who's your favorite? I could use a recommendation. Oh, well, Bourdain wrote some really great historical pieces. She trailed off, then swallowed. Hard. She lifted her eyes to him and seemed surprised when he was still paying attention to her. For his part, Carswell was feeling a little surprised, too. It had been a long time since he'd really looked at Kate Fallow, and she seemed prettier now than he'd remembered. Even if it was the kind of pretty that was overshadowed by the likes of Shan or Elia. Kate was softer and plumper than most of the girls in his class, but she also had the largest, warmest brown eyes he thought he'd ever seen. Plus, there was also something endearing about a girl who seemed entirely floored by no more than a moment's worth of attention from him. But maybe that was just his ego speaking. Is there a certain type of drama you like? Kate whispered. Carswell twisted his lips up in thought. Adventure stories, I guess, with lots of exotic places and daring escapades and swashbuckling space pirates, naturally. He followed this up with a wink and watched, preening inside, as Kate's mouth turned into a small, surprised O. Then Professor Gosnell cleared her throat. This is supposed to be individual study, Mr. Thorne and Miss Fallow. 20 more minutes, and then you can partner up. Yes, Professor Gosnell, said Carswell without missing a beat, even as the redness stretched to Kate's hairline and a few students snickered near the back. He wondered if Kate had ever been reprimanded by a teacher in her life. He slid his gaze back to Kate and waited, 5 seconds, six, until her gaze darted uncertainly upward again. Though she caught him staring, she was the one who instantly turned back to her desk, flustered. Feeling rather accomplished, Carswell took to scanning through the names. A few sounded familiar, but not enough that he could have named any of their works. He racked his brain, trying to remember what exactly he was supposed to be doing for this assignment anyway. Then, Kate Fallow leaned over and tapped her stylus against a name on the list. Joel Kimbrough. United Kingdom born 27TE. His list of works spilled down the screen, with titles like Space Ranger on the Ninth Moon and The Mariner and the Martians. Carswell beamed up at Kate, but she had already returned her attention to her own screen, without any sign of her blush receding. The next 20 minutes were spent scanning through Joel Kimbrough's extensive body of work, while his mind churned through different scenarios in which he could get Kate Fallow to help him with his math homework. Preferably, just to let him copy off her, so he wouldn't need to put any more time into that wasteful venture. When Professor Gosnell finally told them to choose a partner, Carswell scooted his desk closer to Kate's without hesitation. Would you like to work together? She gaped at him again, no less surprised than the first time. Me? Sure, you like histories, I like adventure. Match made in heaven, right? Carswell, hissed a voice behind him. He glanced around. Blakely was seated behind him, leaning so far over her desk that her nose was practically on his shoulder. I thought you and I could be partners. 1 second. He lifted a finger to her, then turned back to Kate and plowed on. Actually, there's something I've kind of been meaning to ask you for a while now. Kate's jaw hung, and Carswell feigned a sudden onslaught of uncertainty and scooted his chair a bit closer. You know how we're in the same math class? She blinked, twice, nodded. Well, I was thinking, if you're not busy, and if you wanted to, maybe we could study together one of these days, maybe after school. He followed this up with his easiest smile, practiced and precise. Kate could not have looked any more stunned if he'd just proposed that they move to Columbia State together and become coffee bean farmers. You want to study? With me? Yeah, math specifically. He rubbed the back of his neck. I'm not doing that great in it. I could really use your help. He added a drop of pleading to his expression and watched as Kate Fallow's eyes widened and softened simultaneously. Those pretty, enormous brown eyes. Carswell was surprised to feel a jolt behind his sternum, and suddenly he was almost looking forward to his studying time with Kate Fallow, which was a rather unexpected twist. Because, of course, she would say yes. Although it was Blakely who spoke next. Carswell, we should get started on this assignment, don't you think? There was an edge to her tone that Kate must have noticed, something that hinted at jealousy. With a glance back at Blakely, Kate looked more flustered than ever, but then she nodded and gave an awkward shrug. Sure, all right. Carswell beamed. Great, and also, I hate to ask this, but would you mind if I took a look at today's assignment? I tried to do it last night, but was completely lost. All those equations. Mr. Thorne, said Professor Gosnell, suddenly hovering between him and Kate. This is literature class. Perhaps you could use your time to discuss literature? He tilted his head back to meet her gaze. Oh, we are discussing literature, Professor. Clearing his throat, he tapped the screen, pulling up Kimbrough's 39th published work. Marooned in the Asteroid Labyrinth. As you can see, dramatist Joel Kimbrough often played on themes of loneliness and abandonment, in which the protagonist is forced to overcome not only external obstacles, like space monsters and malfunctioning spaceship engines, but also the internal devastation that comes with complete solitude. His works often employ the vast emptiness of space as a symbol of loneliness and the battles each of us face against our own personal demons. In the end, his protagonists often overcome their feelings of insecurity only after they accept the help of an unlikely assistant, such as an android or an alien or, his mouth quirked to one side, a pretty girl who happens to be a skilled marksman when she's handed a high-powered ray gun. A wave of tittering rolled through the class, confirming Carswell's suspicions that he now had an audience. "So you see," he said, gesturing again at the screen, "I was just telling Miss Fallow that the themes in Kimbrough's works relate to my own personal struggles with math homework. I so often feel lost, confused, completely hopeless. But by joining forces with a pretty girl who understands the problems I currently have to work through, I may yet overcome the obstacles laid out before me and achieve my ultimate goal, namely high marks in math class." He gave a one-shoulder shrug and added for good measure, "And literature class, naturally." Professor Gosnell stared down at him with her lips pursed, and he could tell she was still annoyed, although simultaneously trying to hide a twinge of amusement. She sighed. "Just try to stay on task, Mr. Thorne." "Yes, Professor Gosnell." He glanced at Kate, and though she wouldn't meet his eyes, she was nibbling at her bottom lip and almost smiling. The rest of the class was still chuckling as Professor Gosnell turned back to her own screen and began listing some of the literary terms students should be using to discuss their assignments. Words like themes, obstacles, and symbolism. Carswell smirked. Then a voice broke out of the mild chatter, loud enough to reach Carswell, but quiet enough to make it seem like it wasn't intentional. "If it's a pretty girl that he needs to help with his problems, he's out of luck if Kate Fallow is the best he can find." Someone else guffawed. A few girls giggled before putting their hands over their mouths. Carswell glanced back to see Ryan Doty smirking at him, a friend of Jules's. He shot him a glare before turning back to Kate. Her smile had vanished, her eyes filling with mortification. Carswell curled his hand into a tight fist, having the sudden, unexpected urge to punch Ryan Doty in the mouth. But instead, as the class quieted down, he ignored the feeling and once again scooted his chair closer to Kate's. "So like I was saying before," he said, teetering on the line between casual and nervous, "maybe we could eat lunch together today out in the courtyard?" He'd have to cancel the afternoon's card game, which would put him behind schedule. But if he could submit today's homework during math, complete and on time, it would be the fastest way to start turning around his marks. And he only had a week to show his dad that things were improving before mid-July break started. "What do you say?" Kate's jaw was hanging again, her blush having returned full force. "Carswell!" Sighing, he didn't hide his glare as he turned back to Blakely. "Yes, Blakely?" Her glower put his to shame. "I thought you and I were going to be partners today." I'm not sure, Blakely. I'm afraid I already asked Kate, but..." He grinned shyly in Kate's direction. "I guess she hasn't given me an answer yet." Blakely harumphed. "Well, then, maybe we should call off our date to the dance, too. Then you two can go fight obstacles and achieve goals together." He sat up straighter. "Huh?" "Last week," Blakely said, curling her fingers around the edge of her desk, "I asked if you were going to the peace dance, and you said I'd be the girl you asked if you did. I've been planning on it ever since."
"Oh, right."
Carswell was losing track of how many girls he'd said some version of this line to, which was probably bad planning on his part, but at the same time Blakely had asked, he'd been hoping to get her to invest in his Send Carswell to Space Camp fund.
"Unfortunately," he said, "it's looking like I may be babysitting my neighbor's toddlers that day, 2-year-old triplets."
He shook his head.
"They're a handful, but so blasted cute, it's impossible not to love them."
Blakely's anger fizzled into warm adoration.
"Oh,"
Carswell winked, "but if they end up not needing me, you'll be the first to know." She squinched her shoulders up from the flattery.
"But Do you want to work together today?
I'd love to, Blakely, but I did ask Kate already. Kate?
Kate had her head down, her hair falling over her face so that he could only see the tip of her nose. Her body had taken on a new tenseness, her knuckles whitening as she gripped the stylus.
It's all right, she said without looking up at him. I'm sure the teacher will let me work on my own. You can work with your girlfriend.
Oh, she's not. We're not.
Blakely grabbed his arm.
See? Kate doesn't mind. You said that you chose Joel Kimbrough?
Clearing his throat, Carswell looked first at Blakely, then back up at Kate, now hidden behind an invisible wall.
Fine.
He leaned toward Kate again. But are we still on for lunch? So I can, you know, check out that homework assignment?
Kate tucked her hair behind her ear and leveled a look at him that was both annoyed and intelligent.
It told him that she knew exactly what he was doing, or trying to do, to her, to Blakely, to every girl he'd ever asked a favor from.
Carswell was surprised to feel a tingle of shame down his spine.
Her jaw twitched.
I don't think so, and we probably shouldn't study together after all.
Turning away, she fitted a pair of speaker plugs into her ears, and the conversation was over. In its wake was a feeling of disappointment that Carswell couldn't quite place, but he didn't think had very much to do with math.
Seven card royals, said Carswell, dealing another hand of cards. Aces are wild, triplets beat the house.
Why don't we ever play the doubles beat the house? Asked Anthony, picking up his cards and rearranging them in his hands.
Carswell shrugged. We can play that way if you want, but it means the pots will be smaller. Not as much risk, not as big a payout.
Triplets are fine, said Karina, needling Anthony in the side with her elbow. Anthony's just afraid he's going to lose again.
Anthony scowled.
It just seems like the odds are a little biased towards Carswell, that's all.
What do you mean? Carswell waved his hand over the pot. I've lost the last three hands in a row. You guys are bleeding me dry over here.
Karina raised her eyebrows at Anthony as if to say, see, do the math. Anthony duly fell quiet and tossed his ante into the pot. They were playing with markers scavenged from the school's lunch bar. Olives were microunives, potato crisps were singles, and jalapeno slices made for fivers.
The trick was to keep Xian, who was seated on Carswell's left and had the appetite of a whale, from eating them in between games.
At the end of every school day, Carswell, as the house, would divvy up the wins and losses between the players' real savings accounts. He'd based his system on the same odds that the casinos in the valley used, allowing him to win about 60% of the time. It was just enough to turn a consistent profit, but also give players frequent enough wins that they kept coming back. It had turned out to be one of his more profitable ventures to date. Karina took the next hand without much competition, but that was followed by a round in which no one could beat the house's required triplets or better, ending Carswell's losing streak. He kept the grin from his face as he raked the pot of food scraps into his dwindling pile. He quickly did the math in his head. He was up from where he'd started the lunch period, nearly 11 univs. Just seven more would put him at his goal for the day and push him into the next bracket of his savings account. Seven univs. Such a small thing to just about anyone in this school.
Just about anyone in the entire city of Los Angeles.
But to him, they equaled 16 weeks of freedom. 16 weeks of being away from his parents. 16 weeks of total independence. He brushed his thumb over his Rampian tie tack for good luck and dealt another hand. As the betting began, he glanced up and caught sight of Kate Fallow sitting on the low stone wall that surrounded the courtyard, the pleated skirt of her uniform pulled snugly around her knees. She was reading from her port screen.
No surprise there.
But it was odd to see her out here at all. Carswell had no idea where she normally spent her lunch hour, but he was pretty sure it wasn't in this courtyard, where he could always be found. The betting ended and Carswell began to dole out replacement cards, but now he was distracted. His gaze kept flicking back to Kate, watching how she smiled at something on the screen, mindlessly tugged at her earlobe and tapped her heels against the wall, seemed to sigh with a hint of longing. Maybe she came to the courtyard every day and he'd never noticed. Or maybe she'd come here today because he'd suggested it, even if the offer had ultimately been declined. Either way, it was clear from the faraway look in her eyes that she wasn't in the courtyard right now, not really, and he couldn't help wondering where she was. Holy spades, was he developing a crush on Kate Fallow? Of all the girls who smiled and swooned and giggled, all the girls who would have handed over their math homework for nothing more than a flirtatious compliment, and he suddenly couldn't keep his eyes off the most awkward, isolated girl in the school? No, there had to be more to this. He was probably just confusing his desperation to raise his math grades and lift his dad's punishment with something that bordered on romantic interest. He didn't like Kate Fallow. He just wanted Kate Fallow to like him so he could swindle her out of her math homework. Just like he swindled everyone. There it was again. That peculiar tingle of shame. "Ha! Suited triplets," said Sheehan, laying out his cards. The other players groaned, and it took Carswell a moment to scan the hands and determine that, indeed, Sheehan had taken the round. Usually he could pick out the winning hand in half a glance, but he'd been too distracted. As Sheehan scooped up his winnings, Carswell determined that he probably should have quit while he was ahead after all. He was back down to 8 univs, one for the day, 10 behind his goal. Boots would not be impressed. "Well done, Sheehan," he said. "One more hand?"
"There won't be time for it if our dealer goes out to space again," said Anthony. "What's wrong with you?"
He cringed, the words reflecting his father's question from just that morning.
"Nothing," he said, shuffling the cards. "Just had something on my mind."
"Oh, I see what he was looking at," said Karina. "Or should I say, who?"
Sheehan and Anthony followed Karina's gesture.
"Kate Fallow?" said Anthony,
with a curled lip that said he highly doubted she was the person who had caught Carswell's interest. Ducking his head, Carswell redistributed a new round of cards, but no one picked them up.
"He was flirting with her in lit class this morning," said Karina. "Honestly, Carswell, everyone knows you're a hopeless flirt, but do you really have to get every girl in the whole school to fall under your spell? Is this some sort of manly conquest you're on or something?"
It was easy for Carswell to slip back into his most comfortable role. Cupping his chin in one hand, he leaned toward Karina with a suggestive smirk.
"Why? Are you feeling left out?"
Groaning,
Karina shoved him away, at the same time that the speakers announced the end of lunch hour. A groan rose up from the courtyard, but was hastily followed by the sounds of footsteps padding back into the buildings and friends bidding each other goodbye for the whole 90 minutes they were about to be separated. Carswell gathered up the cards he'd just dealt and slipped them back into his bag. "I'll tally the winnings," he said, shooing away a fly that was buzzing around the pile of food.
"How do we know you won't take a little extra for yourself?" asked Sheehan, with unhidden distrust.
Carswell only shrugged.
"You can stay and count up your own if you'd prefer, but then we'll both be late to class."
Jen didn't argue again. Of course, a lost univ or two was nothing to any of them, so what did it matter if Carswell skimmed a little off the top? By the time he'd entered the balances into his port screen and put in a reminder to shuffle the money between their accounts when he got home, the courtyard had emptied but for him and the seagulls that were creeping in to pick up the scraps of abandoned food. Carswell slipped his port screen back into his bag beside the deck of cards and heaved it over one shoulder. The second announcement blared. The halls were abandoned as Carswell made his way to second era history. He would be a couple of minutes late for the second time that day, but the teacher liked him, so he couldn't bring himself to be worried about it. And then, through the quiet that was laced with the padding of his own footsteps and the hushed conversations behind closed classroom doors, he heard a frustrated cry.
"Stop it! Give it back!"
Carswell paused and traced his steps back to the hallway that led off to the tech hall. Jules Keller was holding a port screen over his head, grinning, with Ryan Doty and Rob Mancuso surrounding him. And then, there was Kate Fallow, her face flushed and her hands on her hips in a semblance of anger and determination, even though Carswell could tell from here that she was shaking and trying not to cry.
"What do you keep on this thing anyway?"
said Jules, peering up at the screen and scrolling through her pages with his thumbs.
"Got any naughty pictures on here?"
"She sure does stare at it a lot," said Rob with a snort.
Carswell's shoulders sank, first with embarrassment for Kate, then with that inevitable feeling that something bad was about to happen. Bracing himself, he started down the hall. No one seemed to have noticed him yet. Kate squeezed her shoulders against her neck and held out a hand.
"It's just a bunch of books. Now give it back, please."
"Yeah, sleazy books probably," said Jules. "Not like you could ever get a real date."
Kate's bottom lip began to quiver.
"Seriously, there aren't any games on here or anything," said Jules with apparent disgust. "It's the most boring port screen in L.A.
"We should just keep it," said Ryan. "She's obviously not using it, right?"
"No, it's mine."
"Hello, gentlemen," said Carswell at the same moment that he reached up and snatched the port screen out of Jules' hand. He had to get on his tiptoes to do it, which he hated, but seeing the flash of surprise and bewilderment that crossed Jules' face made it worthwhile. Of course, the look didn't last long. Carswell took a few steps back as Jules' hand flexed into a fist.
"What a coincidence," he said. "I was just coming to look for Kate. So glad you found her for me."
He raised his eyebrows at Kate, then quirked his head back down the hallway. "Come on." She swiped at the first tear that started down her cheek. Wrapping her arms around her waist, she dodged around the boys to come stand beside him. But Carswell hadn't taken two steps away before Jules grabbed him by the shoulder and turned him back around.
"What, is she your girlfriend now or something?"
he said, nostrils flaring with, if Carswell hadn't known better, a hint of jealousy. Which just blasted figured. Mocking and bullying a girl would be the way that Jules attempted to show affection. It somehow seemed to fit with that completely messed up head of his. Carswell stifled a sigh. Maybe he could start an after-school flirting 101 class. There were a lot of people in this school who could really use the help. What could he charge for that, he wondered. "Right now," he said, drawing his attention back to the numbskull in front of him and placing a hand on Kate's arm, "she's the girl that I'm escorting back to class. Feel free to spread whatever rumors you want from that."
"Yeah? How about the rumor that I gave you a black eye because you wouldn't mind your own business?"
"I'm honestly not sure people are going to buy that one, given that..."
The fist collided with Carswell's eye faster than he'd have thought possible, sending him reeling back against the row of lockers with a resounding clang. The world tilted and blurred, and he thought Kate may have screamed and something clattered on the ground. Her port screen? Falling from his own hand? But all he could think was,
spades and aces and stars, that hurt.
He'd never been punched before. He'd always assumed it would be easy to bounce back from, but now he had the instinctive desire to curl up into a ball and cover his head with both arms and play dead until they all went away.
"Carswell!"
yelled Kate, seconds before Rob grabbed him by the elbow and yanked him away from the lockers, and then Jules' fist was in his stomach, and he'd probably broken a rib, and Carswell was on his knees, and Ryan was kicking him, and all his senses were made up of pain and grunts and Kate's shrieks. And he really would have thought that he'd have lasted a lot longer than this, but... A gruff voice bulleted through the haze of fists and feet, and Carswell was left blessedly alone, curled up on the school's tiled floor. He tasted blood in his mouth. His entire body was throbbing. As his senses began to register his surroundings again, he realized that Vice Principal Chambers had broken up the fight, but Carswell was too woozy to make sense of his angry words.
"Carswell?"
said a sweet, soft, horrified voice. His left eye was already swelling shut, but he peeled open the right to see that Kate was now crouched over him. Her fingers were hovering just off his shoulder, like she was afraid to touch him. He tried to smile, but felt it probably looked more like a grimace. "Hey, Kate." Her eyes were filled with sympathy, her face still flushed, but she wasn't crying anymore, and Carswell liked to think he'd put an end to that, at least.
"Are you all right? Can you stand?"
Bracing himself, he sat up, which was a start. Kate helped a little, although she still seemed hesitant.
"Ow,"
he muttered. His entire abdomen was throbbing and bruised. He wondered if they'd broken a rib after all.
Aces, how embarrassing.
He would be investing in some good martial arts simulators after this. Or maybe boxing. He'd never be on the losing side of a fist fight again if he could help it. Outnumbered or not.
"Are you all right, Mr. Thorne?" said Mr. Chambers.
Squinting upward, Carswell saw that they'd been joined by two of the tech professors, who were standing with their arms folded over Jules and his friends. Everyone was scowling. Rob even looked a tiny bit guilty. Or maybe he just hated that they'd been caught.
"I'm grand," said Carswell. "Thank you for asking, Mr. Chambers."
Then he flinched and rubbed at the spot on his side where the jolt of pain had originated from. Mr. Chambers sighed heavily.
"You know that all fighting is against school policy, Mr. Thorne. I'm afraid this calls for a 1-week suspension. For all four of you."
"Wait, no," said Kate.
Then, to Carswell's surprise, she laced their fingers together. He blinked at the hands, then up at her profile, and doubted she even realized she was doing it.
"Carswell was defending me. They'd taken my port screen and wouldn't give it back. It's not his fault."
The vice principal was shaking his head, and though Carswell could tell he felt bad about the decision, he also had an expression that suggested there was nothing he could do about it.
"School rules, Miss Fallow."
"But that isn't fair. He didn't do anything wrong."
"It's a no-tolerance policy. I'm sorry, but we can't make exceptions."
Mr. Chambers glanced back at the other boys.
"Mr. Keller, Mr. Doty, Mr. Mancuso, you can follow me to my office so we can calm your parents. Miss Fallow, why don't you assist Mr. Thorne to see the med droid?"
He attempted sympathy when he met Carswell's one-eyed gaze again.
"We'll calm your parents later."
Chin falling to his chest, Carswell cursed under his breath. This was also against school policy, but Mr. Chambers blessedly ignored it.
"Miss Fallow, I'll alert your teacher to forgive your absence for this period."
"Thank you, Mr. Chambers," she murmured, full of resignation.
As Jules and his friends were escorted away, Carswell allowed himself to lean against Kate and push himself onto his wobbly legs with another handful of curses and groans.
"I'm so sorry,"
she whispered as he draped an arm around her shoulders and she began escorting him toward the medroid office.
"Not your fault," he said through his teeth.
Although, now that he had the strenuous effort of walking to focus on, the pain almost seemed to be dulling.
"Almost. You get your port screen?"
"Yes, thank you. And I got your bag."
Then she huffed angrily.
"I can't believe they're suspending you. It isn't fair."
He tried to shrug, but it came out as more general flopping of his free arm. "I was already grounded for mid-July break. A suspension can't make it that much worse."
"Grounded? For what?"
His gaze flickered to her, and he couldn't avoid a wry smile, even though it pinched his throbbing cheekbone. "Poor math grade." She flushed.
"Oh."
Carswell pressed a hand against his ribs, finding that by applying a slight amount of pressure, he could relieve some of the jarring as they walked.
"Yep, I'm grounded until I bring my score back up. Of course, that's not going to happen now that I can't even go to class."
He tried to laugh as if it didn't bother him, but quickly realized what a bad idea that was, and the sound turned into something of a pained cough.
"Oh well, just more time to catch up on my Joel Kimbrough reading, I guess."
She tried to giggle, maybe to make him feel better, but it didn't sound any more authentic than his laugh had.
"When you're done," she said, I'm sure you could write an amazing paper that explores the parallels between the dangers of space travel as compared to navigating school hallways and social status and...
And parents?
Her laugh was less forced this time. And parents, of course.
I suspect that Martians have pretty much always symbolized parents in those books.
They must, being that they're so... otherworldly.
And terrifying.
This time, her laugh wasn't forced at all, and it gave Carswell a warm, tender feeling somewhere under all the bruising. He wished he could have laughed with her without it causing a flash of pain in his skull.
Think Professor Gosnell would give me extra credit?
I'm sure she would, said Kate. But then, her sympathy was back. It wouldn't help with your math grade, though.
True, if only studying algebra formulas was half as much fun as corny space adventures.
If only. Pursing her lips, Kate glanced up at him through her cascade of hair. Then she took in a deep breath. I'll let you copy my math homework. He raised an eyebrow. Until your grade is up. And when we come back from break, I can help you study, if you still want me to. Thank you. He smiled, and he didn't even have to fake his gratitude, though the relief came with that peculiar undercurrent of shame again. He knew that she felt guilty, that she felt as though she owed him something. He knew he was taking advantage of those feelings. But he didn't argue, and he didn't reject her offer, because in the back of his head, he was already counting up the hours this would save him, the money he could earn with that time. He was already moving past Kate and her port screen and her gentle laugh and the lingering pain from his first fist fight. Already, he was moving on to the next goal, the next dream, the next obstacle. Carswell grinned, just to the point where it started to hurt, and rubbed a thumb over his tie tack. For luck.
After sunshine passes by. At 9 years old, Crescent Moon was the youngest infantry soldier in Luna's great warrior army. She stood at perfect attention in the front line of her platoon, back straight as a pin and arms locked at her sides. She was proud of her service to the Queen. Already, she had been hailed for her bravery and even honored with a Medal of Courage from her Commander General, Sybil Mira, after the Battle of Crescent. Mistress's voice interrupted the fantasy, and Cress snapped a fist to her heart in salute.
Yes, Commander. Mistress?
Some of the older kids snickered down the line, and Cress felt her cheeks flame. Though she had pinned her gaze respectfully to the bunk beds against the opposite wall, she tore them away now to look at Mistress Sybil, who stood at the end of the long, narrow dormitory. Her lips were thinned and white. Cress swallowed hard and lowered her hand. Her body shrank, mimicking the same meek posture the other kids had when they lined up for the monthly blood withdrawals. Of course, she wasn't really a soldier. She wasn't even sure what the word infantry meant. But that didn't keep her from fantasizing, from imagining herself somewhere better than here. Anywhere but here. She couldn't understand why the other shells were so content to accept their stifled existence. Why they mocked her for trying to escape, even if the escape was only in her own mind. Yet mock her they did, at least until they wanted something from her. Then they were as sweet as syrup. Sybil's nostrils flared as she inhaled an impatient breath.
Did you hear what I said, Crescent?
Cress racked her brain, even though she knew it was useless. Her face grew hotter as she shook her head.
I was just telling the rest of your peers that we have received evidence that someone recently hacked into the feed of the educational programming intended for Luna's most promising youth.
Her gray eyes narrowed at Cress.
I was unsurprised to find that the feed had been copied and was now being broadcast here, in the Shell dormitories. Can you explain this, Crescent?
She swallowed and shrank back again, and her shoulder bumped into the boy beside her.
It was my idea, said Callista,
who stood near the front of the line. Sybil's piercing eyes shifted to her.
Don't be mad at Cress. I put her up to it. I just thought... We just thought...
Sybil waited, expressionless, but Callista seemed to have lost her gumption. A silence filled the dormitory, and though the temperature was static, Cress began to shiver. Finally, Errol spoke.
We thought it could teach us how to read, he cleared his throat. I mean, those of us who don't know how.
Which was most of them. Cress had managed to download a beginning reader's app to their shared holograph node a few years ago, and she and a couple others had made it through the entire course before Sybil had found out and blocked it from them. They had tried to teach the others, those who wanted to learn, but without paper or port screens, it was a slow, tedious process. Most of them wanted to know, though. There was something liberating about it, something powerful. She thought Sybil knew that, too, otherwise she wouldn't have been opposed to it. Sybil began to pace down their line, eyeing each of them in turn, though most of the kids dropped their stares as she passed. She moved like a cat, a proud, spoiled one who hunted for sport, not survival. The guard who had accompanied her waited by the door, attention pinned on the distant wall, ignoring them all.
If it was important for you to have the skill of reading, said Sybil, do you not think I would have ensured that you were taught? But you are not here to be educated. You are here because we have hopes of curing you. You are here to supply us with shell blood so that we might study your deficiencies and, perhaps, someday, we will know how to fix you. When that day comes, you will be reintroduced as full citizens of Luna.
Her words turned sharp.
But until that day, you have no place in civilized society and no purpose beyond the blood that runs through your veins. Reading is a privilege that you have not earned.
She stopped in front of Cress and turned to face her. Cress cowered, though she wished that she hadn't. There would be no Medal of Bravery today. Reading was a privilege she had not earned. Except, she felt that she had. She had learned the language of computers and networks, and she had learned the language of letters and sounds, and she had done it all on her own. Wasn't that earning it? It didn't matter. Knowledge was something that Sybil could never take away from her.
Crescent.
She shuddered and forced herself to look up. She braced herself for a reprimand. Sybil certainly looked angry enough. But instead, Sybil said,
You will have your blood taken first today, and then you will prepare for a departure. I have a new assignment for you.
Cress held the bandage against her elbow as she followed Mistress through the underground tunnels that connected the shell dormitories to the rest of Luna's capital city. The shells were kept separated from the rest of society because, supposedly, they were dangerous. They couldn't be manipulated by the lunar gift, which meant they posed a threat to the queen and the rest of the aristocracy, those lunars who were able to manipulate the minds of people around them. It had, in fact, been an enraged shell who had assassinated the previous king and queen, leading to the banishment of shells in the first place. Cress had heard the story 100 times, this proof that people like her weren't fit to be around other lunars, that they needed to be fixed before they could be trusted. But still, she couldn't understand it. She knew that she wasn't dangerous, and most of the other shells were children like her. Almost all of them had been taken from their families when they were newborns. How could someone as powerful as Queen Levana be afraid of someone like her? But no matter how many times she tried to get a better explanation from Sybil, she was rebuked.
Don't argue. Don't ask questions. Give me your arm.
At least, since Sybil had learned of Cress's affinity for computers, she had started to pay a bit more attention to her. Some of the other kids were starting to get frustrated. They said that Cress was becoming a favorite. They were jealous that Sybil kept taking her out of the dorms. No one else ever left the dorms, and Cress had even gotten to go to the palace a few times, a story that the younger kids never tired of hearing about. Even though Cress had only gone in through the servants' passages and had been taken straight to the security control center. She hadn't seen the throne room or anything interesting like that, and she certainly hadn't seen the queen herself. Still, it was more than most anyone else in the dormitories had seen. and they loved to hear her tell the tale, over and over again. She suspected that Sybil was taking her to the palace again this time, until Mistress took a turn that she had never taken before. Cress almost tripped over her own feet in surprise. The guard, pacing an arm's reach from her, because again, she was dangerous, cast her a cool glare.
Where are we going, Mistress?
The docks, Sybil answered without pretense. The docks? The spaceship docks? Cress furrowed her brow. She hadn't been to the docks before. Did Sybil need her to program special surveillance equipment into one of the royal ships? Or update the parameters for the ships that could enter and exit Artemisia? Or... Her heart started to thump, although she did her best to temper it. She should not hope. She should not let herself be excited, because the thought that Sybil might be taking her on a ship? That she might be going into space? Her eagerness was almost too much to bear. She knew that she shouldn't let herself wish for it, but she wished it anyway. Oh, the story she would tell. The little kids would crowd around her to hear all about her space adventure. She started looking around the corridor with new eyes, trying to mentally record every last detail that she could take back to them later. But these corridors were so bland, with their polished, smooth stone walls, that there wasn't much to tell. Not yet.
Mistress, she ventured to ask, what will you have me do at the docks?
Sybil was silent for so long that Cress began to regret asking. Maybe she'd angered her. Sybil didn't like being asked rudimentary questions. She didn't like it much when Cress talked at all, other than, yes, mistress, and of course, mistress, and I would be happy to complete this task for you, mistress. And though Cress had never been fond of Sybil, had in fact been terrified of her since before she could remember, she still wanted Sybil to be fond of her. She wanted Mistress to be proud. She imagined Sybil bragging about her to the Queen, telling Her Majesty of the young prodigy in her care, who could be so much more useful to the crown if she weren't trapped in those awful dormitories all the time. Cress hoped that if she could impress Sybil enough, someday the Queen would have to take notice of her. Maybe she would be offered a job, and she could prove that shells weren't dangerous after all. That they want to belong and be good, loyal Lunars just like anyone. Maybe, just maybe, the Queen would listen to her.
Do you remember, said Sybil, jolting Cress from a daydream in which Queen Lavanna herself was praising Cress for her brilliance and essential service to the crown, when I asked you about conducting more extensive surveillance on the leaders of the Earthen Union?
Yes, mistress.
You told me that our current software was unsuited for the surveillance we had in mind, that the feeds were too easily disrupted or dropped, that the very act of obtaining live audio feeds from Earth would no doubt be noticed and likely traced back to us. Is that correct?
Yes, mistress.
Sybil nodded.
Your work has
been invaluable to me of late, Crescent.
Cress's lips parted. It was rare to hear anything remotely resembling praise from Sybil, and her chest warmed at her words. They turned a corner, and the corridor ended at an enormous set of double doors.
I believe, Sybil continued, not looking at Cress as she pressed her fingertips to a scanner on the wall, that I have resolved all of the dilemmas that were keeping us from achieving our objectives.
The doors slid open. Cress followed Sybil onto a wide platform that encircled a cavernous domed space filled with the shimmering white bodies of royal spaceships. The floor beneath them was glowing, casting the shadows of the ships onto black ceilings. At the far end of the dock, the massive barrier between the atmosphere-controlled area and outer space was sealed tight.
What was more? There were people. Not many, but a dozen at least, mingling around one of the larger ships.
They were too far to see clearly, but Cress could make out vibrant colored clothing, and one of the men was wearing an enormous hat, and Sybil grabbed Cress's elbow and yanked her in the opposite direction. Cress gasped and stumbled after her.
Do not look at them, said Sybil.
Cress frowned. Her arm was stinging, but she resisted the urge to rip it out of Sybil's grip.
Why? Who are they?
They are members of Artemisia's families, and they would not appreciate being gawked at by a shell.
She dragged Cress down a ramp to the dock's main floor, releasing her elbow once they were separated from the aristocrats by the svelte forms of the spaceships. It was disconcerting to be walking on the glowing floor. It felt like walking on a star. Cress was so distracted that she crashed into Sybil when she came to an abrupt stop. Sybil looked down at her, lip twitching, and didn't respond to Cress's hasty apology. She just turned and nodded to the guard, who opened the door to a small pod ship. It couldn't have fit more than 3 or 4 passengers, but while it was small, it was also luxurious. A faint strip of lights curled around the ceiling. A holograph node was projecting the image of a burbling water fountain in one corner. The benches behind the pilot were covered in a fabric that made the blankets in the dormitories look like animal feed sacks. Sybil gestured for Cress to get in, and the invitation was so unexpected that Cress could only stand and stare at the pod ship's interior in disbelief.
Really? She whispered. We're leaving Artemisia?
She felt momentarily dizzy, with elation, but perhaps also a bit because of the blood taken before.
We are leaving Luna, said Sybil. Now get in.
Cress's mouth ran dry.
Leaving Luna?
It was more than she had dared to hope. A ride in a spaceship. A real trip into space. The other shells would be so jealous. Pulse hammering, she climbed into the ship and settled into the farthest seat. Sybil sat facing her and immediately switched off the fountain holograph, almost as if she found the sound annoying. The guard took the pilot's seat, and within moments, Cress could feel the subtle hum of the engine vibrating through the soles of her feet. Her mounting excitement was met with almost equal amounts of anxiety as the ship lifted, hovering over the other stationary vehicles. It began to glide toward the massive exit. Mr. Sybil still hadn't given her any indication as to what this new job was that she was meant to do. Though she had managed to successfully complete every task given to her before, she could sense that something was different about this one. Bigger. More important. This could be her chance to prove to Sybil, to everyone, that she was more than just a shell. She was valuable. She deserved to be a citizen of Luna. She couldn't fail. With a shaky breath, she pulled her hair over one shoulder and began twisting the ends around her wrists. She thought of cutting it a year ago, but the other girls had talked her out of it. They told her how beautiful it was, how lucky she was that it grew so thick and strong. They said she would be crazy to cut it, so she didn't. Now she supposed it had become a sort of security blanket for her.
She often caught herself fidgeting with it when she was nervous.
The massive doors had opened, making the entire dock rumble. And now they were sitting in a holding chamber, waiting for the doors to seal closed again before they could be released into space. The anticipation was choking her. She was leaving Luna. Leaving Luna. Never in all her dreams had she thought that she, a lowly, forgotten shell, would have the chance to see life beyond Luna's protective biodomes. But here she was, only 9 years old, and setting off on her first great adventure. The enormous ancient metal doors cracked open and slowly, slowly peeled back. They revealed the barren white landscape of Luna first, crater-pocked and desert still. And beyond them? Beyond the horizon? Beyond Luna? Stars. Stars like she had never seen, had never imagined seeing. The sky was alive with them, and in their midst, proud and beautiful and right before her eyes, was planet Earth. Their ship began to coast forward again, gradually at first, but picking up speed as they abandoned Luna's weak gravitational pull and soared away from its surface. Cress didn't realize she'd put her hands on the windows until her breath fogged against the surface. She pulled back, revealing 2 handprints that perfectly framed the blue planet. Sybil's cryptic words churned in her head. Was she taking Cress to Earth?
It would indeed solve all the issues Cress had pointed out with regards to spying on the Earthens. She had to get closer. She needed better equipment and more time, but mostly, she needed to close the physical distance between them. Was Sybil asking her to be a spy? Earthens wouldn't suspect a child like her, and she was a shell, perfectly suited to fit in with the ungifted Earthens. She could infiltrate government databases. She could commandeer every media feed on the planet. She could obtain secrets from every government official and private comms from every citizen. She could be the best spy in lunar history. And best of all, she would no longer be just a shell, trapped in a dormitory and forced to give blood every 4 weeks. She would have a blue sky. She would walk with bare feet on real grass. She would splash through ocean water and climb to the tops of skyscrapers and go to the theater and dance in the rain and... She noticed Sybil watching her, and only then did she realize she had an enormous grin on her face. She smothered it as quickly as she could. How long will it take to get there? She asked.
Hours, said Sybil, unclipping a port screen from her white thaumaturge coat. Your first objective will be to access the notes from the weekly meetings between Emperor Ryken and his advisory cabinet. I suggest you begin planning how you will accomplish this.
Cress pressed her lips together and nodded eagerly, her thoughts already churning with ideas. No doubt the meeting had an android secretary recording the notes, possibly even taking an audio or video recording. And as long as that android had net connectivity... She leaned her head against the bench and turned to look at the planet again while she mulled it over, coding and security hacks buzzing through her thoughts. Stars, but the planet was beautiful. More breathtaking than she'd imagined it. The projected images from the holograph nodes didn't begin to do it justice. How it sparkled and glowed and moved, always moving. The wisps of clouds always churning. It was as though the planet itself was a living organism. She started to hum, as she thought and dreamed and planned. She hummed a lot when she was working. It helped her channel her thoughts sometimes, but today her thoughts were too disjointed to be focused. How different her life looked from just this morning. How quickly everything had changed. The journey passed in silence, but for the quiet tap of Sybil's fingers on the port screen and Cress humming to herself. The pilot never spoke. It was almost as if he wasn't even there. But then, that's how all the guards acted. Invisible. She didn't blame them. Working for Mistress Sybil often made her wish she was invisible, too. Her gaze reattached to Earth. It reminded her of a lullaby one of the older girls had taught her years ago. One that Cress still loved to sing to the children at Lights Out. Sweet crescent moon, up in the sky. Won't you sing your song to Earth as she passes by? Your sweetest silver melody, a rhythm and a rhyme. A lullaby of pleasant dreams as you make your climb. Send the forest off to bed, the mountains tuck in tight. Rock the ocean gently and the deserts kiss goodnight. Sweet crescent moon, up in the sky. You sing your song so sweetly after sunshine passes by. Cress caught sight of the guard peering at her in the window's reflection. She stiffened, realizing she'd been singing aloud. He quickly looked away, but Sybil was watching her now, too. Not just watching. Glowering. Cress gulped. Sorry. Sybil set her port screen on her lap, fixing her attention more fully on Cress.
You probably don't realize how old that song is. A lullaby that's been sung on Luna perhaps as far back as colonization.
I did know that, Cress said before she could stop herself. It was her favorite song. She'd researched it once. Sybil's eyes narrowed almost imperceptibly.
Then you must know that
that the song was written at a time when Earth and Luna were allies. Some consider it to be a song symbolizing peace between the two planets. Some feel that it is unpatriotic today, that it suggests Earthen sympathizing.
Heat rushed to Cress's cheeks again, and she sat straighter, shaking her head.
That's not why I like it, she said. I just like, I mean, it has my name in it. Crescent Moon. Sometimes I think, I wonder if maybe my parents named me for the song.
The thaumaturge gave an abrupt snort, startling Cress.
That is highly unlikely, Sybil said, looking out the window. From what I recall of your parents, they were not given to such flights of fancy.
Cress stared at her.
You knew my parents?
Sybil was quiet for a time, expressionless but for a smug tilt of her mouth. Finally, she slid her attention back to Cress.
The only thing you need to know of your parents was that they willingly gave you up to be killed in the Shell infanticide.
Her eyes glinted, pleased with her own cruelty.
Your mother herself put you into my arms. All she said was, "A Shell, how mortifying."
The words struck Cress harder than they should have. Of course she'd known that her parents had given her up to be killed. That was the law, even though Shells weren't actually killed, just hidden away. But most civilians didn't know that. Her parents would have believed she was dead, and Sybil never tired of reminding the Shells how unwanted